It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll talk to a chef who's bringing new flavors into traditional Irish cooking.
First, in February of 2011, Act 10 was introduced in the state legislature. Act 10 is the legislation that effectively ended collective bargaining for public employees in Wisconsin. The bill sparked massive protests at the state capitol. It led to a recall effort, which ultimately failed to remove Governor Scott Walker from the governor's office. And today is the five-year anniversary of the bill being signed into law.
Act 10 also faced several court challenges over the next few years, but was ultimately upheld by Wisconsin's Supreme Court.
So how has Wisconsin changed since Act 10 became law in the state, and how has it affected politics?
We'll take your calls in just a little bit to get your take on Act 10 and what it's meant for politics here in the state. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Mike Wagner joins us now. He is an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So how would you say in a nutshell that the political landscape and in general the political climate has changed in Wisconsin since Act 10?
I would say I kind of think about it in two ways. First, in terms of the laws that have been passed by our state government, those have become much more conservative in terms of limiting labor unions' right to collectively organize, becoming a right-to-work state, passing a large cut of the university system, taking tenure out of the university or taking tenure out of the state law. A lot of those things have been quite conservative from the lawmaker standpoint. And on the other hand, from the public side, there's been a slight growth since the recall election in the percentage of Wisconsinites who refer to themselves as liberal. Not a big growth, but a little bit of one. And so there's been a slight shift back to the left in the last couple of years. Not enormous, but a noteworthy change nonetheless.
So that latter thing, are you suggesting that there's a causal relationship there, that Act 10 somehow led to more people identifying as liberal? A small number of people, but still?
Well, correlation doesn't equal causation, but it is something that has happened. And I think, you know, part of the landscape here is that Governor Walker has become less popular since his presidential run. And at the same time, after the recall election, Tammy Baldwin was elected to the U.S. Senate in a statewide election, and she's one of the more liberal U.S. senators. But then again, by the same token, Governor Walker won re-election reasonably comfortably. And so some things have been getting more liberal in who's been getting elected, but the state legislature is getting more conservative. Another example of Wisconsin's polarized politics.
Right, polarized politics. And one question there, has it gotten worse since Act 10, or has it always been? Has this always been the story in Wisconsin? Because one take on this is that part of the legacy is that it made politics in Wisconsin even more divided. It sharpened those divisions. But other people say, well, you know, the state elected Tommy Thompson for years, but votes for Democrats in presidential elections. So this is just Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think, you know, the changes have been a little starker. And so I do think that the level of vitriol and the kind of vilifying rhetoric the two sides use against each other, even on the floor in the state assembly and state senate, have really been ratcheted up since Act 10. And it's always been the case that Republicans and Democrats have disagreed with each other. It's been the case that progressives and Republicans disagreed with each other. That's always been true in Wisconsin. But I think in the last few years, Wisconsin has been particularly contentious. And that's been fueled by resentment among some voters. It's been fueled by anger toward Governor Walker among other voters. And it's been fueled by the behavior of many of the lawmakers that we have in state government.
In terms of who emerged the victor from Act 10, now obviously the bill remains intact. It's enshrined in state law. So in that sense, it's a victory for Scott Walker. But on the sort of philosophical side, or the proof is in the pudding side, I guess, has it done what the governor said it would do? And has he, in effect, won that question?
Well, I think he's won the question of whether it will remain state law for some time. The Republican Party has controlled the districting of the state legislative offices and are likely to be able to remain in control of the state assembly for a long time to come. The state Senate is a potential for the Democrats to capture in the next election, but is still a pretty difficult goal for them. In terms of the proof of Act 10, Wisconsin's economy, and by most measures, is lagging behind other Midwestern states. Wisconsin has a low unemployment rate, and Wisconsin has been adding jobs, not to the degree that Governor Walker promised. And it's been the case that the state in terms of the average wages people have and their own attitudes about what the economic future is likely to be have been pretty negative since Act 10.
What's your sense about how Wisconsin at large, the citizens of Wisconsin, what they think about Act 10? Is it just divided along partisan lines, or is there a more nuanced answer?
There's a lot of division that's partisan, but there's also divisions based on where people live and the kinds of jobs people have. And this really was a time where politics infiltrated the lives of people in ways that politics hadn't before, because now you might have had a friend who was a teacher or a government worker. And when Act 10 was at play, there's evidence from the Marquette Law Poll that Wisconsinites, in some cases up to a third of them, reported that they literally stopped talking to someone they knew because of their views about Act 10. And that is something that normally doesn't happen in politics. But when people whose friendships cross ideological lines in day-to-day life see politics infiltrated and have these conversations about what about the pensions of state workers, what about their right to organize, what about the rights they have as compared to those who are also working hard but don't have those same benefits if they don't work for state government. All of that together ginned up a lot of resentment and a lot of interpersonal conflict in a way that politics usually doesn't accomplish for people or do to people. And it really did around that time of Act 10. And there have been some lingering resentments that have continued to this day.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about the five-year anniversary of Act 10 being signed into law here in the state of Wisconsin. Now, looking back at that Act 10 struggle, which is now historic in Wisconsin's history, one of those key moments came when 14 state senators left Wisconsin to stall a vote on the bill. And here's what Governor Walker had to say when they left.
I believe that those, at least some of those state senators, will come back. If we fail to pass this bill by Tuesday, we lose $165 million worth of savings. If we continue down that path, we start seeing layoffs.
And Mike, through the lens of history, how is that move seen today? 5 years later, it's not a whole lot of time that's passed, but how is it seen?
I think that in the broader Wisconsin political community, people who supported the Democrats at the time, many of them now regard that as a mistake. They regard it as a move that, while it kind of symbolically made the case against Act 10 and also was practically preventing a quorum, the blowback from legislators not doing the job they were elected to do is something that at least some people in those circles, in research I've been conducting, suggest some people think that was a mistake. Other people say that's a badge of honor and that it was a point of pride to say legislators were doing their jobs by preventing something that they thought was fundamentally wrong for the state. And so I think a lot of that comes down upon whether you were on the winning side or losing side in that discussion.
And again, looking at that moment, former state senator from Milwaukee, Spencer Coggs, was a member of those 14 state senators who fled to neighboring states. And that group, among supporters, of course, got the nickname the Fabulous 14, a little more complicated now. But here's what he had to say when they returned to the state.
We wanted to make sure that our voice was heard, and we couldn't make our voice heard while we were here. So since they wouldn't listen to our voice, we decided they should listen to our absence, and our absence spoke volumes.
So now here we are, 2016. We've got incredibly divided partisan government here in Wisconsin. Do you think, looking back to that move to flee, did that influence it at all? Did that make things more challenging coming forward to build a relationship that would be based on any kind of bipartisanship?
I'm not sure if that made it more difficult. It was already a difficult moment. And as you heard in the soundbite there from the lawmaker, one reason those lawmakers left was they felt that the majority wasn't listening to them. And a common tactic when you're in the majority is to let the minority debate all they want, not say anything, and then vote whatever it is you want to happen. And that's sort of how the minority party saw it in that situation. And so I'm not sure that particular decision prevented the crossing of party lines on future kinds of legislation. Sometimes more of the name-calling and the kind of aggressive gestures that we saw in this last session, sometimes those can have more effects on day-to-day working relationships.
Mike, just briefly, because I want to get to our callers, but watching this year's presidential race unfold and this incredible division between voters and within a single party in the case of the GOP, do mm-hmm. you see any of Wisconsin's struggles in that microcosm of Act 10 reflected in the nation as a whole now?
I think there's something to the idea that Wisconsin politics is somewhat of a microcosm of national politics, where there's a pretty deep division amongst the liberals and conservatives, and it's pretty evenly contested between the liberals and conservatives, both in Wisconsin and in, you know, broad national elections. And so I think there is something to that. I think that we are living in a more contentious time. And often what happens when you're in the majority is the most extreme members of your majority say, well, let's do what we say we're going to do, and more moderate members blanch at that a bit. And we're seeing that in the Republican Party in Congress with the fall of Speaker Boehner and the rise of Paul Ryan. We're seeing that in the Republican national race for the nomination for president with Donald Trump and Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and John Kasich, plus the cast of 13 others who dropped out before them. And it's you know, it's one of the problems of being in the majority is that the true believers want accomplishments, and the moderates maybe don't want such extreme policy behavior.
We're talking about how Act 10 has changed the political landscape in Wisconsin in the 5 years since it was signed into law. Mike Wagner is with us now. He's Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the state in the 5 years since Act 10 was passed? Is Wisconsin better off or worse off? And have we as a state recovered from the political divisions that grew out of the law? Are there people you're still not talking to anymore? Friends, family, maybe. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about Act 10 and the 5 years following its signing into law. And we're taking your calls. Do you think Wisconsin is better off following Act 10? And how have you seen the state shift politically? And what has it meant for divided politics here in the state? What about that question that Mike raised? Are there people that are you're not talking to maybe anymore because of Act 10 and the fallout there? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our guest, Mike Wagner, stays with us. He's Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison.
And we take a caller now. We've got Dwayne joining us in Dalton. Dwayne, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a state worker. I work for the Department of Corrections, and I took a $5,000 hit right off the top of my paycheck when Act 10 went into effect. A lot of people do not believe me, but I can show you the paperwork. It has hurt me and my family extremely, especially when I'm trying to put a daughter through UW College. It is very hard. I've got to pick up work on the side, or I've got to work overtime just to make up that difference, and it's hurt us for a long time already. And we have gotten no pay raise in the last 5 years. Eight if you count the one-and-one that we've gotten before, but then they had all the takeaways, which added up to about 1.5 to 2% per year. So something needs to be done with corrections as a whole and get rid of something here to make it more progressive so that we can get more money in our pockets so that we can go out there and spend money. The economy is not going to grow because he took all this money away from all these people in the state of Wisconsin, and now he's complaining that the economy is not growing. Well,
Dwayne, thank you for that. I want to make sure we get our guest, Mike, in on that question there. He says he's, Dwayne, less well-off than he was before Act 10. Proponents of the bill would say, yeah, but we'd be Republicans, the legislature have been able to keep taxes down and money in pockets in other ways like that.
Yeah, that's kind of the crux of the argument is who lost direct benefits or salary benefits or organizing benefits and negotiating benefits right away in Act 10, like the caller who had a real consequence that still affects, you know, him to this day. And then arguments on the other side from the governor who would point to holding the line on property taxes. Democrats will counter to say the average property tax decline is in the single digits of dollars and isn't very huge. And so that benefit might not be worth the other consequences. But, you know, Governor Walker campaigned clearly on wanting to keep those things down, and the voters chose him three times in the last 5 years or 6 years.
Thanks a lot for the call, Dwayne. We're going to go now to John. John joins us from West Bend. John, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. Originally, the argument with Act 10 was to balance the budget. That was the argument. I believe in, if my figures are correct from my memory here, in 2009, the state budget was around $62 billion. And now the state budget is about, I think it's around $70 billion. We have borrowed more money since that time. So the budget, we're still in debt after that time. And during that time with Act 10, it was also mentioned by a number of the Republicans that this was just a fight that they were picking with the state public workers union. Well, we found out later that it was also private sector unions. You know, and the effect of Act 10 led to a lot of different things. The tax structure became completely changed also. Taxes were cut on some of the wealthiest people in the state. Taxes on businesses were cut. And we can see the effect of what's been going on. Poverty levels keep rising in the state. There was just a report that came out of the state of Wisconsin in UW-Madison about poverty levels going up. The job loss, you know, which the entire country had a lot of job loss in 2009 and 2008 when the economy crashed with the Great Recession. Well,
and John, we're going to leave it there. A lot of things to respond to there. Mike, what about that laundry list of things John sees? Is Wisconsin, in his mind, not as well off?
Well, John's quite right that the bill was proposed. I mean, the name was, you know, Budget Repair Bill was how it was initially kind of proposed. And John is quite right that that was the stated impetus behind Act 10. Economically, Wisconsin has not been performing as well as comparable states like Minnesota or Illinois or Ohio in terms of job creation, median wages, and things of that nature. And the state has also had, as we saw in the legislative session this wrapping up, big problems with being able to fund transportation, and tax receipts are down and not meeting expectations. So can you tie all of that to Act 10, I think, is a question. We might not know the full complement of the answer to that yet. But since then, those things have not been accomplished in the way that they were originally described.
Well, let's take a look at unions before we finish our conversation here. Now, part of this was, you know, public unions strongly affected, and Wisconsin is a right-to-work state now, so private unions
right.
as well. How has that affected the political landscape in Wisconsin?
I think it's weakened a traditional power center in the Democratic Party in terms of labor union membership and labor unions who are able to engage in political spending, usually on advertisements in presidential and statewide campaigns, congressional campaigns, and state-level state government campaigns, and also in getting volunteers to help get out the vote and promote candidates. And I think the progressives in the state of Wisconsin have taken a big hit with what's happened to labor unions, their membership, and their ability to get what they would prefer for their workers since Act 10.
And do you see that as the case going forward as far as you can see, or is this something that could turn around? Or is it just that labor unions don't have the utility to their employees that they used to have?
Their muscle has been considerably affected in Wisconsin since Act 10. The great thing about democracy is that democracy is for people who don't get what they want, because there's always another election that comes around. And presently, Governor Walker is not very popular compared to his previous numbers in the state of Wisconsin. He has hinted that he may run for re-election. His numbers now would suggest he would be in more danger of that than the other times that he ran. And if a new governor came in with a Democratic state Senate as well, there would be an opportunity to amend or tweak these things in some way. But given the strength of the Republican Party in the state assembly, I think it would be difficult to imagine a wholesale overturning of Act 10 or something like that in the near future.
Talking to Mike Wagner right now, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at the UW-Madison. We're talking about Act 10, 5 years after it was signed into law. And we'll go next to Jackie. Jackie joins us in Madison. Jackie, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I was a state employee for many years, and I'm retired now. And when I worked for the state, I enjoyed many, many, many benefits as an employee. For example, the day I got hired, I had 3 weeks of paid vacation. And I worked in the private sector for most of my life. And I thought that folks that complained about this job maybe were a little bit of crybabies.
All right. Well, thank you, Jackie. And he was saying he saw some real benefits there, and maybe it was overstated, some of the things other public workers were saying.
Well, I think that is a real sense that many Wisconsinites have about public workers. And I think there is a real resentment of some of the benefits that those workers have received in quarters where people don't receive them. I think that's a real thing that has happened across the state that was probably it was probably in people's minds before Act 10 was introduced, but certainly became salient as the political discussion got so vitriolic and pitted public workers against against others. I think that's been a real thing that's happened in Wisconsin for the last several years, and is chronicled in my colleague Kathy Kramer's new book, The Politics of Resentment.
And I want to ask you about that, actually. What about the kind of the politics of geography, the mm-hmm. urban-rural divide in Wisconsin? What happened with that post-Act 10?
Well, I think, you know, there's been this this notion that scholars such as Kathy Kramer, who I was just talking about, have uncovered related to something that we might think of as rural consciousness. And so sometimes liberals like to say, well, gosh, you know, from an economic point of view, those in rural areas should be with the Democrats because of their policy positions on different kinds of bills. And that overlooks how many rural Americans and rural Wisconsinites think of the work that they do and the value that it has and their own positions on issues that aren't exactly directly tied to economics, issues related to moral questions or cultural questions and cultural values. And I think folks in rural areas feel abandoned by Madison, abandoned by the state government, abandoned by elites in such a way that they're misunderstood, devalued, and thought by elites that they're not capable of making decisions that are the best for them. And that's an offensive thing, you know, that would be offensive, you know, people who have that kind of view. And it's I think it's clear to understand how that has helped foment another divide in our state.
We could keep going, but we're out of time. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner, Associate Professor of Journalism, Mass Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was with us today to talk about Act 10, 5 years after it was signed into law.
Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk with an Irish chef and TV host about some culinary ways we can celebrate St. Patrick's Day next week. I'm Rob Farrakh.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listen to Central Time. I'm Rob Farrakh.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday. St. Patrick's Day getting awful close. Is it next week already?
Yep, next week Thursday, I believe.
And we're thinking about lots of warm, comforting things, Culcannon, Irish mashed potatoes, beef stews. And it got us thinking about comfort food, the comfort foods that we turn to when we need a little pick-me-up and we need to have that wrapped in a blanket feeling.
And now we're turning to you for some advice and some input. What is your favorite comfort food to cook and, of course, to eat? What says comfort food to you when you're in that zone where you just need something to perk you up or maybe mellow you out? What is your comfort food? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share your comfort food with us.
And by the way, if you're Irish and some of your favorite comfort food comes from Ireland, let us know what that is. If you turn to a nice warm Irish soda bread or a beef stew, we'd love to hear about that as well. 800-642-1234. And Rob, what about you? Where do you turn when you need a little pick-me-up?
Well, you said an Irish beef stew, and I don't eat beef all the time, but that definitely pops to mind as an awesome comfort food. So that is one I will give it up for and eat. Let's see, breakfast for dinner is a good. I think we're doing that at home tonight.
Agreed.
It's actually a nice way to go for comfort food. And soup, of course. I make a lot of soup all through the winter, just veggie soup, kind of fridge soup, whatever's lying around, and that's often my comfort food.
Right, so I tend to cook, two things are on my repertoire. Well, two things, but
tell us both the things you know how to cook.
I'll tell you both the things. That used to be true, actually. I could only cook two things, special chicken and grilled cheese.
Special chicken was your date food, as
yes, when I was cooking for somebody else. But now pancakes, I think, in the evening, just like
that's
you,
a good one.
Is really comforting to me. And also anything involving cheese. Anything cheesy will comfort me, endlessly.
Yeah. Oh, and oven-roasted veggies, big comfort food for me now. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234, sharing your comfort foods. We've got Kevin on the line in La Crosse. Kevin, hi.
Hello. Hey, a great topic for a beautiful Friday afternoon.
Definitely. What do you got for us, Kevin?
Well, I was born and raised in Texas, and I was the first generation to be born in Texas. My father on back was born in Louisiana. And my comfort food is my homemade gumbo.
Hmm.
So what's the secret to your homemade gumbo?
The secret is the roux. You start with a good roux. And it takes a long time if you do it the slow way, or you can do it the fast way, and it only takes about 15 minutes.
Which way do you do it?
I like the slow way. It's just what I grab a couple of beers, and because you can't leave it once you start it, and I enjoy the smell, and I enjoy the 45 minutes it takes to make the roux. Yes.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, Kevin, I'm going actually to New Orleans for the first time ever in just a couple few weeks. What's the secret? What do I look for to make sure I'm getting some good gumbo?
Yes, we were just there 2 weeks ago. My wife had a conference there. And you're not going to find a bad gumbo.
All right.
So the thing you look for is just the different, you have the different meats still put in. Some people like just seafood. Some people will put sausage, chicken. You know, I was born and raised with anything that would fly, slither, crawl. You can put it in a gumbo.
All right. Well, I'll probably draw the line at slither, Kevin. But thank you so much for that comfort food suggestion. Gumbo. I haven't eaten a lot of gumbo, but I'm planning to try some in
New
Orleans.
I don't think that I've ever eaten gumbo. I mean, I know how to make a roux. Mine would be the quick kind, not the 45-minute kind. But yeah, gumbo is a comfort food. I'm really intrigued by that. But I will say sort of the process for me of just standing over a pot and stirring is
comforting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So if it takes
that
a while and it's in a big, simmering, yummy-smelling pot, it fits.
Well, thanks for getting us started, Kevin, with your comfort food. How about you? 800-642-1234. What is your comfort food to make or, better yet, have made for you? 800-642-1234 is the number. And Nathan is with us next in Appleton. Nathan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us?
My comfort food, I know this is probably going to be for a lot of the deer hunters, is venison wrapped in bacon with grilled asparagus.
So venison and bacon and asparagus gives it a little sort of crunchy thing in the middle, huh, the asparagus?
No, actually, you wrap the bacon on the outside.
Okay. And how do you cook
and
that up?
You just put the venison on the grill until it's medium rare, and then put the asparagus on and let that go for about 5 minutes.
I have a feeling that bacon features in a lot of people's favorite comfort foods. You wrap something in bacon and you feel happy.
Yep.
Nice. Well, Nathan, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Venison wrapped in bacon with, here's the touch for a little bit of good health, grilled asparagus for Nathan.
Grilled asparagus is, that's a good one. I don't know if that's a comfort food for me, but it's definitely a favorite, or just, cast iron skillet asparagus.
A comfort veggie.
Mashed potatoes.
Comfort veggie.
Potatoes, not a veggie, starch, but mashed potatoes is hard to go wrong. It's real simple.
I am mostly vegetarian. I love vegetables, but I still don't think of, vegetables along with comfort food as much. I mean, they may be in there.
Yeah.
God bless them. I love veggies, but they're just not as comforting as, something drenched in cheese.
True. Definitely true.
All right, let's go back to our callers. Nathan, thanks a lot for that. Jason, you are next in Hudson. Jason, hi.
Hey. Hey, I got a comment and a question for you guys. Comment first. So the comfort food that really takes me in is just your basic Hormel chili, a whole lot of cheese, corn chips to dip in it, a little glass of whiskey, and a classic war movie.
Wow.
You know what? That sounds great. You're setting the whole scene for us there.
Yeah, and, you just can't do one without the other, except for the whiskey. But, all right, anyway, my question is, this is probably something you guys can figure out towards the end of the show, but what percentage of our comfort foods are cheese-related?
100% in my case, Rob.
Definitely not all of them. I mean, yes, a lot of comfort foods for me are cheese-inclusive, definitely, but not all of them for me. Most of yours, obviously, your Hormel plus cheese, Jason. Anything else has cheese in it prominently?
Pardon?
Any of your other comfort foods have cheese in them?
I don't know too many of my other foods that don't have cheese in them.
All right.
Yeah, we are, Jason, in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I was going to say, we may be a bit of a skewed audience on the whole cheese as comfort food question. But you could let us know, 800-642-1234. Tell us your comfort food. That's what we're looking for. Cheese or not.
I guess I don't put cheese in my pancakes, so there's one.
There's somebody out there who does, and they could call in right now. Tell us your secret for cheddar pancakes.
All right, let's go to Carlin next. Carlin is in Milwaukee. Carlin, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
I love peanut butter and pickles. That's my comfort food. If the pickle and the peanut butter,
is
so good.
Peanut butter and pickles. So are we talking sweet pickles or dill pickles?
Oh, sure, dill. All the way.
Wow. Okay. I was kind of going to be willing to go there with you if you said sweet pickles, but now, dill, that's crazy. What do you like about that?
I don't know. It's just, it's salty, it's crunchy, and I mean, I like peanut butter on anything. It doesn't really matter, but just, I don't know, that you just got to try it, I guess. I also like cucumbers and peanut butter, too, so.
Sure. Well, Carlin, thanks so much. I see the ad of the future. You got your pickles in my peanut butter. No, you got your peanut butter on my they're delicious. But I do actually, somebody turned me on to this peanut butter on savory type sandwiches with cheese, onions, pickles, whatever. Actually, if you just think of peanut butter as a condiment instead of butter, it's really good. So this isn't as weird to me as it seems to be to you.
All right, I may have to try this. Well, right now, I feel like you're proposing something insulting to nature, but yeah. I'll keep an open mind.
The concept of just dipping the pickles in the peanut, and then the peanut pickle juice is going to soak into the peanut butter.
But peanut butter is really good.
Right.
So I guess we can start there and assume that maybe it plays nicely with other foods.
PB&J, a good comfort food, too.
Definitely.
And an easy one. All right, Carlin, thanks a lot for that suggestion. Tim is with us next in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. So I have three main comfort foods. One is macaroni, cheese, tuna, and peas with a little bit of diced up raw onion in it.
Ah.
Mm.
And another one is leftover cold spaghetti sandwiches. You put it in a cake pan, your leftovers,
uh-huh.
And then the next day you can cut it with a, you know, and treat it like almost like you're cutting like a brownie.
But wait,
do you
put
it between a couple pieces of bread?
Do you bake it in the pan in the oven?
Nope.
Until you store it.
After you have spaghetti, you mix the sauce and the noodles together, and you cover it in a shallow pan, and then the next day you can slice it and stick it on bread, and you know it's carb overload.
Yeah.
and what kind of bread?
Anywhere from classic white bread to leftover garlic bread, if you're lucky enough to have leftover garlic bread.
Nice. Right. I can see that. And then what's number three, Tim?
Number three, I'm headed to get right now. I'm headed for Chicago to get Italian-style hot beefs.
Okay. Ah. Well, that sounds really good. All right. Some interesting. The mac and cheese, I bet, is a lot of people's comfort food.
Yeah.
And that I think of as like, sometimes comfort food is going back to the childhood thing. And I think of mac and cheese as a memory of kidhood.
And do you remember after September 11th, there were all those news stories about how sales of macaroni and cheese were skyrocketing and people, it showed up on menus all over the nation. Macaroni and cheese came back. I think maybe in part of, you know, September 11th, people really did need comfort and cheese.
And so, you know what? I hardly ever make them, but something like scallop potatoes.
Mm.
I really like it. And it's so off my radar, but that, we heard from some of our colleagues on this. Adam says shepherd's pie. That's a good one. Shepherd's pie just makes me happy, Adam says. Ground beef, onions, cream of mushroom soup on the bottom, garlic, cream cheese, mashed potatoes on top. Thanks for that, Adam.
And we're talking comfort food right now for Food Friday, and we're hearing from you. You're our guest today. Let us know where you turn when you need a little pick-me-up, a little extra comfort. You just want to feel like the world is a safe, happy place through your tummy. Let us know what that is at 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
More of your suggestions coming up after a look at the latest news with J. Carlisle Larson. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and it is Food Friday. And today we're talking to you. We're getting a handle on what your favorite comfort foods are. The nights right now, they're a little chilly. Yes, we have a little bit of spring in the air, but in the evening, you kind of want to bundle up, feel safe and warm still. So what do you cook? What makes you feel good?
Pumpkin bread is one that I like to make all through the fall and the winter. That's when it's fun to bake and then fun to eat, especially when it's still nice and warm. Well, let's see what else our listeners have on their plates. Sarah is with us now in Lafarge. Sarah, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. And greetings from the Driftless area, where we are surrounded with tons of great food.
Awesome.
My favorite comfort food is basically anything curried. Anything.
And are you talking like a spicy Indian curry or Thai curry? What kind of curry do you like best?
My favorite is probably a Thai inspired curry that's chicken, sweet potatoes, coconut milk, and a yellow curry powder that's mostly turmeric, some other good stuff in there. But it's sweet, it's warm, it's filling, it's the best.
Yeah, okay.
That
I'm on board
great.
With the whole curry plan. Yeah, I do like that is a great comfort food.
I agree with that. I probably would not make it myself because I'm not comfortable enough making it, but I'm really open to curry. We were at a store and we saw a bag of curried potato chips, which was a first for us. Tried them, and they're good. I think curry is just all-purpose yummy.
Definitely. And I used to try to make up my own mixes of spice and stuff, and now I realize, oh, they sell curry paste, and it's I'm sure a real chef would sneer at it. It's always like 9 times better than anything I'd put together myself. So that makes it pretty easy, actually.
But props for trying.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah. A lot of people suffered through a lot of bad food though, for my first efforts. Well, how about you? What's your comfort food? Call in now at 800-642-1234.
800-642-1234. What is your comfort food? What do you cook on that chilly evening, maybe one like tonight, between halfway between winter and spring? 800-642-1234. And we're going to go next to Phil. Phil's joining us in Mount Horeb. Phil, hi.
Hi. I'm glad to hear other people express comfort food in the bread vein. You know, wheat and gluten have taken a bad rap, haven't they? Mm. But fresh home-baked bread that has a great crumb, warm out of the oven, smear it with some Wisconsin butter. It's hard to beat.
That's fantastic. I'm totally on board with this, Phil. I have a new tradition. I'll have to see what happens. I've been making a loaf of bread every night when Downton Abbey is on. It's usually in the oven when Downton Abbey is on. And it's the best thing. I used to be terrified of making it. Now I love it. And it is. You're right. It's totally comforting. What kind of bread do you make?
I make a light whole wheat flaxseed bread. It's my favorite. And I could give a tip here.
Yeah.
If your hands are arthritic or you have carpal tunnel or something like that and the idea of kneading bread discourages you, what I often do, I make bread for our church for communion every Sunday. And the easy way to do this is to do the first process, the mixing and the kneading, in a bread maker. And then take it out after the bread is kneaded and has gone through a couple of rises, and you're all set. Let it rise once in a low-temperature oven between 100 and 112, 15 degrees, and let it rise for about 50, 55 minutes, and then bake it for about 30 minutes, and you get just a lovely free-form loaf or a dish loaf.
That's a great idea. Someone actually loaned us a bread maker, and we haven't used it yet, but I did not know you could do that. That's great. You're obviously advanced at this, Phil.
Oh, I do it every week. I'm for years now, so I've got
it. Well, they're counting on you there at the
church.
They
are, absolutely. Well, we wouldn't have communion every Sunday if but other people bring, you know, wine or grape juice, and it's a wonderful tradition in our church.
Mm, thanks for sharing that with us, Phil. Appreciate it. And we'll take our next caller. Alex joins us from Eau Claire. Alex, hi.
Hey there. I want to say that my comfort foods come from whatever we serve at Thanksgiving dinner. So whenever our family gets together, we don't do that very often. Huge family, just brings back memories. Like foods like stuffing, mashed potatoes and gravy, turkey, any just savory foods.
Yeah, that's fabulous. There is something so quintessentially comforting about Thanksgiving food. Totally agree.
Alex, I got to ask, though, how much of it is the food? How much of it is the setting and the company?
50-50.
50-50. All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Alex. Yeah, I mean, especially actually the comfort food for me is not the Thanksgiving food itself. It's the Thanksgiving leftovers when you lump them all together the next day or two.
Yeah,
I'm on board with that. Blob of Thanksgiving in the pan. We'll go back to our callers now as we ask for your favorite comfort foods on this edition of Food Friday. Still time for you to join in. 800-642-1234. The food that it comforts you to cook, the food that it comforts you to eat. And we'll go back to our callers now with Vincent on the line in Milwaukee. Vincent, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you got for us, Vincent?
Well, I have to go back to the curry. I was listening to that young lady talk here, and I was trying to call, but I was getting a busy signal. And I have to tell her, you know, and like the female host that you have there, she was saying that she was, you know, afraid to attempt it, but my father taught me a recipe, and it's American curry. It's so simple, and it's the only food my grandchildren will eat. They say they can live on it. They're upset that I'm not over there making it right now. They're like, you know,
all right, I'm listening, Vincent. This better be easy.
Okay. It's very simple. Okay, the Swanson's chicken broth, you get the big boxes of it. You get two of those.
Uh-huh.
You dump them in the pot, and then you get two containers of Breakstone sour cream. You dump those in there, too. Okay, now, like a saucepan or a skillet, you dice up some garlic and onions, and you saute it low and slow. If they start turning brown, you're done. You got to start over. So So once those get nice and soft, you add a teaspoon of oil with that. You dump that right in there with the mix. Okay, now I take a little bit of cilantro, too, and I throw it in there. Now all you got to do is take those frozen chicken breasts. You take them frozen, whole the way they are, you throw those in there, too. Now, it's boiling. Now you're going to just turn it down to simmer. And about every half hour, you come back and you stir it. And I usually let it go for over 3 hours. I let it bubble and bubble. Sometimes I keep a little bit of extra broth around, just add it. And now the main ingredient, I forgot to tell you, that yellow curry powder.
I was wondering where the curry came in.
Yeah, the McCormick is the best I found is that McCormick. It comes in the little glass bottles. You pay a couple more dollars for it, but it's worth it. And I'm good with, like, 5 tablespoons of the stuff because it's not, when you're using that much broth, it's not really that strong. Huh. So after about 3 hours, those chicken breasts are so tender, they just shred apart in there. And I'm not good with making rice, so I do the boiling the bag rice, the minute, you know, minute rice, the boiling bag rice, and then you just you put a scoop of the rice on the dish and you spoon some of that over there, and it's, oh my God, I'm telling you, it will make your tongue clap your brain. This stuff is so good. And even your other caller, she's got to try this too, because it's like I said, it's the only thing the grandkids like. So there's got to be something good about it. They don't want to eat anything.
Fantastic. Well, get over there and make it for those grandkids right now. So that's simple. Chicken broth, sour cream, onion, garlic, cilantro, frozen chicken breasts, and don't forget the yellow curry powder. Otherwise, it's going to be the most boring curry you've ever eaten.
I think it
eaten.
Would still be tasty, actually. I love sour cream. But yeah, he really sold that. Thank you, Vincent. We may give that a swing.
Oh, pierogies. That's another good comfort food.
But that,
yeah.
You cannot make. That's cannot an make all-day myself. Endeavor.
Yeah.
Right.
And you have to know a recipe. I learned that the hard way. Joe joins us next in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hi there.
What's your comfort food, Joe?
Well, I was making a comment to the person I talked to before I'm on the air with you about it being seasonal. And, you know, it being spring, I was thinking along the lines of, well, what do we find in spring coming up? Morel mushrooms, asparagus, wild-picked asparagus, ramps, things like that. Mm. So when I can go out and forage and find those items, you know, where I'm fortunate enough to find them and have a nice roast chicken, that would be my comfort food for that season. So, you know, it changes with the seasons, but spring being upon us, that's what I was thinking.
Joe, thanks so much for that. I think fall is probably my favorite comfort food season.
Absolutely, because you get into
squash.
Your soups and your stews and your breads.
And your squash. Oh, wait, I already said squash. I really like squash
a really
lot.
You really like
though.
Squash.
Yeah, that's my favorite. Well, thank you all for sharing your comfort foods. Great ideas there. Keep it going over at the Central Time Facebook page. A gentle reminder from your friends here on Central Time that this Saturday night at roughly midnight, it is time to spring forward.
That is to say, it's time to set your clocks forward an hour and, of course, subsequently get less sleep and be really, really grumpy on Sunday morning.
Sure, there's the extra daylight at the end of the day, like that, okay, but losing sleep, that 1 hour of sleep, seems like a big deal. It's a bummer.
And by the way, there's a movement afoot in Michigan to stop changing the clocks altogether, which would put Michigan on Central Time 8 hours out of the year instead of Eastern Time.
8 months out of the year.
What did I say?
Hours.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be a very, very small amount of time.
Definitely
yeah.
Months.
So anyway, Michigan, you know, I know part of you is in Central Time, very small part in the UP. But yeah, the rest of you, join us 8 months out of the year. We'll expand Central Time's domination of the nation. So yeah, do you usually remember to set your clock when the time comes?
You know, I do these days because I usually hear it here at WPR. Usually some helpful soul sends around an email saying, hey, don't forget to set your clock forward or back. And so I do. Not that I'm happy about it, mind you.
It was always a great fear on the Joy Cardine show where I used to work and you used to work. We used to work on the Tom Clark show, always reminding those guests so that they didn't either show up an hour late for that 6 a.m. slot or worse, in some ways, an hour early, and they're knocking on the door at 5 in the morning.
I am looking forward to the extra light. That's going to be great.
I know. That'll be nice at night. Well, stick around. We're going to round up the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.